Nina, physical violence is not the answer. Psychological domination is the name of the game.
Psychological?
Fell in love with the stories, or it was perhaps the character design that pulled you in, My Life as a Teenage Robot continues to be a cartoon that appeals to fans of all ages. The charm, the humor, and the retro feel all can be attributed to the genius mind of my next guest, the man himself, Rob Renzetti. Next.
Robot Commando is here to help you. He's your one-man army.
No enemy can destroy him. He fights off tanks, hurls missiles one after another. Even a squadron of planes can't stop him. Robot Commando fires his secret weapon. He takes orders from no one except you. Ideal's Robot Commando is battery-operated to obey your command. Adjust the control, speak into the microphone.
Left! Fire!
Ideal's Robot Commando is here to help you. Look for your Robot Commando. He's looking for you.
My name is Dakota.
My best friend is super smart.
But does she know fashion?
That outfit rocks sparkly.
It matches your personality.
But can she keep a secret?
I will keep your secret.
Can your best friend dance?
Let me show you my move.
Super cool! What a spin!
Woohoo!
You go, girl boss.
That was fun.
I like this friend.
What's your name anyway?
My name is Sakura.
Now available in stores.
Up Rob Renzetti on the Wikipedia website, there's a brief mention of his credits as the creator director of the animated television series My Life as a Teenage Robot. After a very successful 3-year run on the Nickelodeon channel, Rob is now redirecting his sights on new endeavors. I was fortunate enough to catch up to Rob to discuss his plans for the future and as well a bit about his past that led him to where he is today. What I like to do, what I traditionally do, is rewind the tape a bit back, so to speak, to the beginning. And if you could, take us back to when Rob Renzetti was just a little animation genius back in the childhood days in Chicago. How did the bug for animation really begin for you? Was it just, you were just hooked on the programming and Saturday mornings like a lot of us, or did you get a lot of support from your family? How did that work for you?
Well, there aren't really any other artists in my family except for a second cousin of mine who's a pretty successful architect. But I think the bug actually was planted, was probably always there, but was kind of activated by my mom. When I was really young, I used to take images from my coloring book and bring them to my mom, and she would take a free sheet of paper and trace the image, and she was a pretty good tracer, actually. She couldn't draw worth a damn, but she could trace a drawing really well. And she would draw it, and she would color it for me, and then cut it out. I think sometimes I did the coloring. And then I had, like, a little paper doll to play around with. And I did this so much that my mother eventually got, and she never didn't deny me, like, no more ever again, but she started, like, saying no because she was too busy, and so I started drawing for myself. And that's really when I started drawing, was when that happened. And, from that day forward, from a pretty young age, I knew that I wanted to be in animation. The other thing that kind of helped along the way was I had a cousin, my cousin David, who was quite a bit older than me. All my cousins were. I was like kind of I was the second generation in my generation. My brothers and my cousins were all like 8, 10, 12 years older than me. Anyways, this cousin had was a big Disney fanatic, though, again, he didn't draw or anything, but he just loved Walt Disney and Walt Disney cartoons, and he had one of the original Art of Walt Disney books, like the first printing, and he had a bunch of, he got whatever Disney book he could get his hands on, and though they've proliferated in many years, they weren't really, I never saw them except for when I went over to my aunt's house, and when I did go over to my aunt's house, I usually sequestered myself in his bedroom if I could get away with it, and just sat there and look through those books for hours on end. So those were kind of the two things that kind of got me going. And once I got going, I pretty much kept going.
So you obviously throughout those years and built yourself up a portfolio to send to Cal Arts. Is that, I mean,
well, that's probably making it sound more grand than it was. I wasn't certainly building a portfolio for very long, but it was, I took kind of a circuitous route to get Cal Arts. I am, because of when I grew up, I graduated high school in 1985, and in 1985, it looked like Disney itself was even going to stop doing animation. You know, the Black Cauldron had come out and been a flop, and new management was in, and nobody was sure, you know, not like I was really involved in, but, you know, the impression was out there that they might not even continue to do feature animation. So, you know, in high school, my drawing kind of tapered off, and I kind of just thought maybe, well, it's a pipe dream to be an animator or a cartoonist. So I went to University of Illinois in Chicago with the idea that I would be a graphic designer, which, you know, if you're going to be an artist, that was kind of the most practical version of being an artist you could be. and they had a great program at U of I, but I didn't get in because everybody who goes into the art school wants to be in the graphic design department, and only a third of them get in, and I was not among that third. So I ended up being an art history major, and after 4 years of being an art history major, I knew I didn't want to be an art history person. I didn't want to be an art historian. And at the same time, sometime late in my junior year, I'd seen an article in the Chicago Tribune about CalArts, but it gave no practical information. And I actually went to the library at U of I and was able to track down some kind of information about CalArts. And so my senior year at U of I, I started working on an animated film. Backtrack slightly, someone that I knew in high school, who I wasn't really close with, but someone that was in my class, actually had gone to CalArts straight out of high school. And so when, you know, 4 years later, he was almost, I think he was either graduated or coming out, and he might have gone the 4 full years to CalArts. So I just found out about this somehow, that he had gone, and tracked him down while he was back home, and we talked, and he said the best thing you could do for your portfolio was do an animated film. So I spent I got all my classes out of the way the first half of my senior year. In the second half of my senior year, I think maybe I had one class or something, but I spent all my time making an animated short in my apartment up down in Champaign-Urbana.
Wow.
And I made I didn't have access to animation paper, so I made my own. I had someone at the local hardware store take a block of wood and put three plastic dowels in it that matched up to a typewriter hole punch that I found. And I punched my own paper and put them on my own pegs. And then I didn't have any backlight. And I just animated a film. My roommate, who was in the film department at U of I, shot it for me on 8mm. It was horrible. I mean, the film wasn't so great, but in terms of how it was shot, it was pretty poor. I sent it off to CalArts. I didn't get in, mostly because I think it was pretty late in their portfolio season, but for whatever reason. And so I didn't get in that year, and I was really depressed. I didn't know what I was going to do. And not to make a super a long story already, super long, but the same roommate, my roommate Andre, he knew there were two people from Chicago, these two brothers, two Russian brothers. One of them was named Alex, and actually the two of us had roomed with Alex the year before, even though we were just rooming with each other now, my senior year. But Alex had a younger brother named Gendy, and I'd met Gendy only once when he'd come down our junior year with a bunch of his high school friends basically to get drunk at U of I, and I really hadn't met him. But Andre told me, well, you know, if you can't get into CalArts, Gendy is going to this program in Chicago at Columbia. There's a small school that's called Columbia in downtown Chicago, and they have an animation program. And I said, well, okay. So I applied and got into Columbia, went to Columbia for a year, Gendy and I coincidentally had a drawing class together. We recognized each other barely across the room, talked to each other after that first class, became friends, hung out for that year, and both applied to CalArts the next year and got in. And actually, we drove out in my old 1973 Dodge Dart, which would have been my grandfather's. We drove across country, and we were roommates at CalArts for 2 years of how I got to CalArts.
So you're at CalArts, and this is during the 90s. And
yeah, I was there from 1990 to 1992.
Okay. Now, it's still a pretty, at that point, and if memory serves me right, it was still a pretty bad time in animation. And it wasn't...
Well, it was a little dicey. Things had turned around a little bit. You know, Roger Rabbit had come out. That would have given me hope, actually, back when I was at U of I, when Roger Rabbit came out and had such a reception. And then when Gendy and I were spending that year at Columbia, Little Mermaid and All Dogs Go to Heaven both came out. So there was activity happening. But yeah, things were still kind of low.
Yeah, so that at that point you're just telling yourself you're gonna see this thing through. It looks like you got some momentum going on there. And your first gig out of school, if I'm correct, landed you in Spain, right? You worked on Batman.
Yes. Yeah. Well, when Gendy and I went to college, there was actually an incredibly talented classmate named Sergio, Sergio Pablos, who was actually from Madrid. And he's a very, very talented guy. He still is, and he still works in animation in Spain. He had worked for a company between our freshman and our sophomore year. He worked for a company that in Madrid that was, an animation company. And when we came back for our sophomore year the following summer, he started telling people they're going to need people because they've gotten a few episodes of Batman the Animated Series. And, Gendy and I, at that point, our goal was both to be animators. And at the end of the year, we got accepted to the internship for Pagemaster, which Turner Feature had come in and grabbed a bunch of people to work on Pagemaster. And a lot of us got internships, basically, which were meant to lead into a full-time gig. And, you work your way up from assistant cleanup to assistant animator and animator. And we thought, we could either do that or we could be animators right away in Spain. So Gendy, me, and three other Americans took Sergio up on his offer to go to this company in Madrid and work as an animator in Spain.
Now, was that your first time out of the country?
No, I actually, back in at U of I, between my junior and senior year in 1988, I traveled with one of my roommates, though not the final roommate, one of my roommates and I went to Europe for 2 months. So, and I have to tell you, it's much better to travel in Europe than to work in Europe. It was not the greatest experience. It was a struggle both creatively and just to live there. One, because everybody smoked.
Smoked
all the time in the building. They gave the Americans a corner with a window that was open so we could have a little relief. They did that for us, but it didn't really help too much. And the company, though we didn't know it at the time, was going bankrupt. The owners of it were corrupt. They had not paid most of their Spanish animators their full salary for over a year. Some of them hadn't been paid anything in a very long time. The money we were promised, we only got a portion of it. They basically would ask us, well, how much money do you need this week?
Oh.
And we would get a little bit of cash. They had us stored in one hotel room for the four of us. I think there were five of us originally, but one guy left pretty quickly, so it went down to four. And we were all in one hotel room, and were supposed to get us an apartment, which they eventually did, but it took them like 3 months to get us into an apartment, and then a month after that, they started going bankrupt.
Oh, my God. Oh, it reminds me when you said that, I've totally forgotten. I landed a gig at a graphic design firm, and I lasted 1 month because, and this may sound ridiculous, but I couldn't stand the smoke. They all smoked. Isn't it weird? You don't think of it now, but it's incredible. I remember telling my wife, I said, God, I think I'm going to die of black lung. I said, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, when you don't smoke and you're surrounded by people like that, it's quite shocking. So, Luckily, I mean, there were a couple breaks built into the Spanish workday where you would take off mid-morning and have like your breakfast after you'd work for a couple hours, and then you had like a late lunch, and that was the end of your workday. So that helped a little bit, but yeah, it was pretty miserable. The only bright spot about that period was that it was the same year as the Barcelona Olympics. Mm-hmm. It was 92, and the 92 Olympics were going on. So a group of us went a weekend to go to the Barcelona Olympics, and that was fantastic. And I realized that I much preferred to travel in Europe than to work there. The language barrier was also a big deal, you know, not being able to speak directly. Luckily, Sergio, you know, spoke English and spoke Spanish, and he was able to translate for us. But, you know, you're dealing with very abstract concepts when you're talking about animation, and, you know, it's hard to talk through a language barrier about animation effectively. So,
yeah.
But for all that, it was actually a good experience, because if not, I would have been a PageMaster intern instead of getting my job on Two Stupid Dogs, which was much more fruitful in the long term.
Yeah, that was my next question. So you feel that experience did help you then to get land the job with Two Stupid Dogs?
Well, it helped in that it delayed my first job in L.A. You know, it stopped me from being at PageMaster and brought me back to the U.S. without a job for a few months. And then through CalArts, through the connections at CalArts, I kind of landed a job. Basically, what happened was Donovan Cook had gone to CalArts with Paul Rudish, and he hired Paul Rudish as the art director. Paul knew Craig McCracken, and Craig got hired as the other art director, and Craig knew me as a storyboard artist, and also Gandhi. We were all in the same class at CalArts, and they hired us as storyboard artists. And that was the beginning of Two Stupid Dogs, which was great. It was a great experience. Starting so what seemed to be high up at the top. I mean, it was really just a small group of us kind of directing what that show looked like and what direction it went in. Donovan gave us a lot of freedom and gave us a lot of leeway to try things, and also gave us a lot of opportunities. I not only did storyboards, but second season on that, I was able to do my first directing. So I would storyboard an episode, then I would direct that same episode. So it was a great amount of control for someone to, you know, see a cartoon from beginning, not to end, but almost all the way to end. So
I love that show. That was hilarious. How long did it run?
It was weird. It had the first season, we got 13 episodes, and it was three cartoons and a half hour. And Two Stupid Dogs was the first and third cartoon, and then we revived Secret Squirrel as Super Secret Squirrel for the middle.
I love that.
And then it did better in the ratings than they were expecting. It didn't do well when it first came out, and then all of a sudden there was a bump or something, and so they picked us up for what was an abbreviated second season, which was basically just to do 13 cartoons so that they could take out the Super Super Secret Squirrel and put those new cartoons in the middle, or rearrange them so that they could have 13 half hours of pure Two Stupid Dog cartoons.
So that's what
we came on that second season. I came back. I only did three storyboards, but that's because I directed all three of them. After I did the storyboard, I would sometimes write and come up with write the outline and come up with the story, then do the storyboard, then direct it.
Excellent.
So that was a great experience, especially for me, kind of getting my feet wet in directing.
Yeah, I remember printing off some pictures of Two Stupid Dogs for my son who discovered it on one of my DVDs, and he's like, "This was like in 2004."
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him taking to school, and a lot of the kids were scratching their heads, like, "What? You know, what is this about?" You know, so
yeah.
And he's just like, "Oh, it's the best show in the world." He loved it.
Yeah, there are lots of fans out there, so it continues to have a following. So that's nice.
Now, getting into Nickelodeon's OEA cartoons, which really was where the My Life as a Teenage Robot first saw the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
For those that aren't familiar with it, it was an animation showcase on the Nick Channel, cable channel, that ran during the late 90s into 2000. Kind of like a variety show for animation shorts. What was the deal with Mina and the Count? Because you had My Life as a Teenage Robot, right? You had Mina and the Count. That was first, right?
I did four different ideas. I got hired on that and then by Fred, and I had I had four slots for the first season. I did four different ideas, And they, none of them were Mean in the Count or Teenage Robot. But what happened with Mean in the Count is after second season happened, I'd actually, Mean in the Count was contractually obligated elsewhere just for a brief amount of time. So I didn't want to do it for season. What happened with Mean in the Count is I actually did the first short at Hanna-Barbera as part of the What a Cartoon series, which Fred Seibert had also started at Hanna-Barbera before he left. And that's where Dexter's Lab came out of that, and Powerpuff came out of that, and Johnny Bravo and Cow and Chicken. Those all started as shorts in that program, and Mina was one of those shorts as well. So I did one short with hope, you know, with the hopes that it would become a series. It didn't become a series there. Fred lured me over to Nickelodeon with the promise that we might do more Minas, but it had to kind of, the contract with Hanna-Barbera had to expire first. So I did four other ideas the first year. And then second year, I got six slots with the idea that I would do six Mean in the Count. So that, that was always the one that I wanted to be my series. It actually had started as my second year student film at CalArts. And then, you know, I developed it a million times. It was really quite a roller coaster ride, both professionally and emotionally, because at points, you know, at points it, there was always a lot of interest in it. It got made as a pilot at Hanna-Barbera. After that, ABC was talking to me about making it as a Saturday morning show, but then ABC got taken over by Disney right after that. You know, like really, like within the week I was having my meeting at ABC, they got taken over by Disney. So that was dashed, and then Fred wanted to arrive at Nickelodeon, and we, you know, with six episodes, and I did five of them, and then Nickelodeon didn't want any more of it. So I had, you know, second season, I've done five Minas. From at least the studio standpoint, it's been a waste and a failure, and I'm feeling down. And Fred, to his great credit, I assumed he was going to give that last slot to somebody else to do another, you know, like Butch was doing Fairly Odd Parents' shorts at that point, and Larry Huber was doing Chalk Zone, but those ended up being series. I figured, yeah, he'll just give Larry or Butch another episode of their, you know, their miniseries to do. And he said, no, I want you to have it. I want you to still have that slot if you've got another idea. So I was like, well, okay. And I thought about three different ideas, and I went in and pitched them to him. And one of them was about this boy robot who had a girlfriend, and it was called My Boyfriend is a Teenage Robot. And I told him about it, and he said, you know, you just got over doing a series about a relationship between a little girl and a vampire. You might not want to do one about a relationship between a teenage girl and a robot now. I mean, they were a little sensitive about the first. I think this is also sensitive ground. And I said, okay. And he's like, you know, maybe you should, you know, maybe think about that some more. And I think the other ideas weren't, you know, they kind of just fell by the wayside. Anyways, the next week I was just driving to the supermarket, and the whole idea for the shorts with changing, making the robot into the teenage girl, making them one character, that came to me, and then the whole plot of the first pilot just kind of fell out of my head on one car ride, literally in a few minutes. And of course, I was scrambling around for a piece of paper in my car to write it all down. And you know, after that, that was it. I came back, I pitched him the new idea. He said, "Great." I did that pilot. It was the last thing I did as part of that program, and it's what eventually became the series, though it took 3 years to happen.
Wow, that's something else. That's great. So for those that may not understand how it works, now when you say you work on these shorts for Oh Yeah or for, you know, What a Cartoons, is this primarily a solo effort? Do you have a team that you assemble to create these shorts? How did that work?
Well, it was a little different in the two programs. In What a Cartoon, they actually had, there was a group of artists that had all pitched things, and a lot of them had their own shows, and what would happen is people would get into teams and trade off. So because they would allow us to do character layout, which is basically taking the storyboard and basically getting it one step closer in animation, you know, blowing it up, doing a background, doing all the character poses full size, and then sending that overseas as opposed to just the storyboard. So the first Mina was laid out here, and I laid it out along with two artists, Miles Thompson and Andy Bialk. They were my layout team. And Miles himself, had, you know, at one point also, I think it came afterwards, had his own What a Cartoon short. You know, and so people would do something on somebody's team, and then, you know, if they work, and then with the hopes that they would maybe create their own short. So you had a little bit of a mini team there. And you got to do layouts for like 4 weeks or something after your board was greenlit or something on Monte Cartoon. Now when it got to, oh yeah, we didn't have that anymore. So it was a little bit more of a solo effort on, but what happened with the Minas is actually, which was, you know, the first season I did all my own boards except for one. I always did the thumbnail boards, and then sometimes I would finish them and clean them up, and sometimes I would hand them off. But second season with Mina, I did all the thumbnails, and then Alex Kerwin was working there. He had done a couple of his own shorts. Second season, he was working on a third short of his own, but also he was there to basically do the final boards for Mina. And actually, Miles Thompson again moved over and was doing a short over there, and he did some of the character designs on Mina. And besides those two guys, I'd always have a BG designer and a BG painter, but that was about it. And the BG painter, one of my BG painters, was Tim Biscup, who's now a somewhat famous artist, and his girlfriend, soon to be wife, Sana Hong. And Sana ended up being the lead BG painter on Teenage Robot when it became a show. So a lot of the key people that ended up working on Teenage Robot were there when working on Mina for me as short, and then eventually on Teenage Robot short as well. So, but that was it. That was about it. You know, there was a small crew. I would do the rough storyboard. Alex normally would clean it up. Some character designs would happen either by him or by Miles. And then Sana or Tim would paint it. And in the meantime, I was doing the timing on it and doing the sheets and getting it ready to go overseas. So you really had a crew of maybe 3, 4, 5 people on each of those shorts. And the idea was you get a community of artists together and they help each other out. And, you know, but you could always bring in, outside people for a particular task if you really were, you know, dead set on using those people. So there was a lot of artistic freedom and also a lot of artistic resources in the person of other people around you. So there were great programs. They were really, even though you're working your ass off because the schedule was tight and you're doing a lot of it yourself, you know, I certainly had a lot of late nights trying to get things done before the ship deadline. But even so, it was, you know, you're doing your own stuff and you're only working on one story at a time and making it as good as you could and then moving on to the next one. So it's great. They were great programs.
So as My Life as a Teenage Robot becomes a series, obviously there's some changes made as far as the character designs and all that. Now, is that influenced by purely just you looking at it saying, God, you know, I really want to make Miss Wakeman look different. I don't like the way, you know, or looking back on it, I think that the hair needs to be different. Or was that something the network said, hey, can you make some changes? Or did you just do that on your own? Or?
Well, there were a couple things that happened. One, 3 years passed between the pilot and when we got picked up as a show. And in those 3 years, the kind of anime look of the pilot had become much more pervasive in Western cartoons, and also just anime was a lot more on, you know, just original Japanese anime was a lot more on American airwaves than it had been when we did the pilot. So the kind of pseudo anime influence that was in the pilot, which, you know, it kind of felt like it was a little bit overdone at this point. You know, when the show got picked up. So we were thinking of redesigning just for that reason. The other thing that happened is Tuck had a baseball cap in the pilot, and they said, well, Timmy from Fairly Odd Parents has a baseball cap, so can you take the baseball cap off? And we're like, God damn it, we like his baseball cap. Why do we have to take it off? You know, yeah. We were saying this to ourselves, Alex and I. What happened when we got picked up is we got a little bit of development time, which was great because you normally don't get that. But we got 3 months. We basically got the summer of 2002 to develop it. And so Alex and I kind of got into a room together over at his apartment before we had studio space and just started redrawing the characters and deciding, well, how do we want to change him? What do we want to do? And everybody changed a little bit. I mean, Tuck, Brad, and Jenny all changed a little bit. Miss Wakeman, yeah, Mrs. Wakeman changed the most. And I think that was mostly Alex's prompting because he just never liked the way she looked. I liked her a lot. I liked the original design a lot. But he's like, I don't see, she's too hard to draw, and we have to have other people draw her. Not that she ended up super easy to draw, but there was a bit more of a system that you could figure out to her final design. And so we kind of decided, we were both fans of 1930s cartoons, and we decided to kind of bring that kind of influence into it more than like modern Japanese anime. But we still kept the Japanese thing in kind of through the Astro Boy influence, which really proceeded from Alex. He was a huge Astro Boy fan. I wasn't that familiar with them. Astro Boy at the time, though I've grown more familiar with it. But, you know, he basically said, everybody in Astro Boy has these weird hair designs. We've got to bring that in. And that's kind of, that was always kind of something that we tried to strive to do, is give everybody weird hair design, especially Mrs. Wakeman. So.
Oh, yeah.
She was supposed to kind of, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say her hair was supposed to kind of look like a rooster's hair or a chicken's hair. That was, everybody kind of had weird hair, but hers was kind of designed to look, kind of make her look like a little nervous bird.
I had that. I don't think I have this in my list of questions, but I just started thinking about it. How much contact did you have, or do you have, or did you have with the voice talent? Because I tell you what, some of the voice talent you got on there are spot on. I mean, I love I love Jenny's voice. I love Mrs. Wakeman's voice. I mean, who picked that, the talent for that?
I think everybody from the original pilot was recast for the series except for the voice of Brad. In the pilot, the voice of Brad was actually a woman, which isn't uncommon for adult women to play adolescent boys. But that woman had actually moved to New York, so she wasn't available. We left a man named Chad Dorick, an actual man, to actually play a male character, adolescent male character. Otherwise, the other leads were all the same as they had been in the pilot. And some of them, like the voice of Jenny, she was kind of a newbie to voiceover, but Candy Milo, the voice of Wakeman, was a veteran and still is. She still works, and I see her frequently because, I've worked on Foster's since my show, and she was one of the voices on Foster's, Home for Imaginary Friends, and she's just in a million different shows. And Audrey Wasluski, the voice of Tuck, has actually gone on to have a burgeoning live-action career. She's actually kind of a tertiary character on Mad Men now, and she's been on The West Wing in the past, so I haven't seen her in a while, but she's moved beyond the voiceover world.
Wow. Yeah.
Usually what happens is that you have a casting director who you work with who knows the voice talent and brings people in that they think are appropriate for the role. And I had a couple voiceover people I worked with. The first one, Margaret Tang, was she was there for the first two seasons. She was great. She usually was pretty good in with a small discussion between the two of us, getting the right voice talent in there for all the various guest stars that happened in the various episodes. So,
yeah, I was fortunate enough to interview June Foray, and I'll tell you what, you talk about that was she also did some adolescent. Voice. Just amazing. Just amazing. I mean,
yeah, I've never worked with her, but she's a legend, of course, and she's great.
Now the 3 years we're talking about between the pilot of Teenage Robot and the actual series,
mm-hmm.
You were working. You can correct me if I'm wrong here, but you were working on another series with Greg Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened to Robot Jones?
Right.
And which is really, it's like, here you are with two robot themed shows, you know?
Yeah.
Were you ever subconsciously trying to make sure there was no crossover, or was it just one of those things, you know what, this is generally my idea, that's generally his idea, if there's anything that's crossing over, it's purely coincidental? I mean.
Yeah, no, it's that was never a concern, though there was buzz about that before anybody saw my show because of the similarity in titles and kind of similarity in subject matter, but I knew, I'd done my pilot before that show ever happened, in between worked on it, and I knew from working on it that it was going to be nothing like my show in terms of tone or subject matter. I knew it was a completely different show. I was actually more worried about stepping into Powerpuff Girls territory because Craig was a good friend of mine, and I'd done some work on Powerpuff, you know, on and off for years, and you know, it was a superhero, a female superhero, so I was more concerned about it being too close to Powerpuff. So the only conscious thing I did was in the design of the show, which was always kind of there, even from the pilot, was, you know, the Powerpuff Girls are kind of active superheroes who are proud to be superheroes, and that's their identity. And I made Jenny kind of the reluctant superhero who was kind of, you know, at least initially in the series, didn't want to do her job, wasn't interested in doing that, wanted to be a normal teenage girl, which of course she can never be. But I felt like if I took that, the main character, if her basic direction or basic drive was the opposite of what the Powerpuff Girls' drive was, that I would be fine, and the stories wouldn't be similar. So that, you know, that concern was there for me at the beginning. But, you know, as the show developed, it became less and less of a concern. And Craig actually is a big fan of my show as well as I'm a fan of his. So I don't think at the end he was felt like they crossed over at all. So
that's great. Did you enjoy working on Dexter's Lab and Samurai Jack and all those and Powerpuffs? Was that a really good time, good experience?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you know, that was my group. You know, Gendy and Craig and I had all met. Well, you know, Gendy and I had met before CalArts, but as I said, but we met Craig our freshman year at CalArts. A lot of the guys that worked on it were people that we knew from CalArts or people that had followed a year or two after us at CalArts. You know, it was Gendy and me and Craig and Paul Rudish and a guy named Jason Rote, who's the writer on it, who all of us, you know, were kind of running the show. I mean, Gendy was the first among equals, but we kind of were like the brain trust, and we all sat in a room and came up with the ideas, and you know, we did a lot of the boards, and if not did them, supervised them. You know, on that show, which is a method we've followed through to this day, is basically everybody got in a room, put the board up on the wall, the guy who did it pitched it to everybody else, and everybody was free to tear it down or say what they liked or give suggestions and give gags. And, you know, that's been, you know, whatever won in that room usually was what ended up in the show. So it was a very collaborative time on Dexter's. After Dexter, I went over to Nickelodeon to do the shorts and came back and worked on Powerpuff and Samurai. But, you know, I've always feel comfortable working with those guys because we all have kind of share the same philosophy and the same sensibilities in terms of the kind of cartoons we make. So, you know, the most recent experience of that is me working with Craig on the last couple seasons of Foster's. You know, I basically came in and was able to help him out in the story room and also, you know, help him in post. I took over editing and retakes and doing the sound mixes for him. And, you know, we think along the same lines, so it's easy for us to work together, and it's always fun to work together. So yeah, I love that time, and I wouldn't have ever left that group if I hadn't had the chance to do my own thing at Nickelodeon, which, you know, was my driving goal, was to get my own series. And so, you know, I did whatever I had to pursue that goal.
Yeah. Now for those who may not be familiar with the way it works with a teenage robot, Mrs. Wakeman had these robot models, I guess different versions, XJ1
right.
through XJ10, and my son was reminding me the other day. He says you need to find out if there really is an XJ10, and you know. So I guess my next question, and just by the way, Jenny was XJ9.
Yes.
Was there? Did you ever have a character model sheet or anything for XJ10?
No, I don't. She never made it to a model sheet. She was always like a threat that was sitting there for Wakeman to use against Jenny. But if we had gotten a fourth season, I think we would have introduced XJ10 at one point. I had some plans for that in the fourth season, but you know, we only went to three seasons, so XJ10 never saw the light of day, and now she never got drawn. So I think the idea was going to be that she was going to be basically a more socially successful robot than Jenny, not necessarily a better superhero, though she would have the capability to be better. But the fact that she would be more socially acceptable than Jenny would drive Jenny crazy. You know, that she would be a success at school. That was one idea. The other idea was that she would be actually younger. She would be a younger sister to Jenny, a la kind of Buffy and her sister. But I, since I hated that on Buffy, I don't know that I ever would have brought that into play on my show. But yeah, no, she never really got off the drawing board. We're definitely going to, she gets mentioned one or two times in the show, but she never saw the light of day. So
this next question kind of alludes back to, you had mentioned this, your influence, some of your influence being that of the cartoons of the early 30s and late 30s. I had to say that there was an episode I watched the other day, Pest Controls, was one of the very early ones, if not mm-hmm. like the second one.
Mm-hmm.
You had the mutant lab rats or lab mice.
Mm-hmm.
That was that. So because the minute I turned it on and I'm watching, I'm going, oh my God, this reminds me of like 30s cartoons, you know?
Yeah, well, that was one of the most overt 30s references we made, was making the rice look like basically demented or simplified versions of Mickey Mouse and all those
Mickey
other
Mouse.
1930s and mice. Yeah, that was actually, it was in the first episode, though. It was the first cartoon production-wise that was produced. So, yeah, we put that into the fourth episode. But yeah, that was a fun one to do, and we were kind of finding our legs in terms of design right then. But we liked Vladimir's design. We liked the way he looked. We brought him back once later in the series to gang up with some of Jenny's other secondary villains. But that was a fun episode to do. That was very, very, very early in the process, very early. So, but I'm glad you liked the look of it.
Yeah, it was phenomenal, and I love the final. The crowning touch was the threat of the Mickey Mouse pants, the outfit.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yes. Well, we tried it. We made most of our cultural references a little bit more oblique, but that was as obvious as we got. I was surprised that Nickelodeon let us do that, considering how litigious Disney is. But I think it kind of slipped under the radar, and so yeah. It was fun to get that in there.
And where did you come up with the, or how did you come up with the cluster, the concept there?
Well, I'm trying to think how it came up with it. I think it really came back to the idea that Jenny wanted to belong, that she wanted to fit in, and that, you know, that was an impossibility on Earth. So I wanted her to be tempted by an alternate society where she could truly fit in. And mostly so that ultimately she could learn that fitting in isn't the most important thing that can happen to you. You know, that sometimes it's not the right thing to fit in. So, also so we could bring robots in, so we could have robot on robot action on the show and get some good action sequences out of it. So when I was thinking about villains, I knew I wanted to have, you know, a very pedestrian villain in the guise of Brit and Tiff, who are basically just, you know, high school students, even though they're, you know, ridiculous, outlandish high school students. And then I wanted something more, you know, bigger, something more global. So the cluster was what came out of that. And I always knew I wanted there to be, at first I wanted there to be like a central family that led the cluster, and that's where Vexus came from. The other main characters were kind of not really a family in the end. You know, when we came up with Smitus, he was just her general, and Krakus, who came along much later, those were kind of the only returning members of the cluster we ever saw. We kind of figured that out. And then of course her daughter was the only family member we eventually met, when we did the hour special. But, you know, the concept was there, and the characters kind of came together slowly as we worked through our episodes. Though I know I always knew I wanted, you know, the Queen, Vexus, and we were lucky enough to get Eartha Kitt to play her, which was great. It was really our only continuing celebrity cast member, but she was always fantastic, and she always brought a lot to the role.
Excellent, yeah, no doubt. Now, I'm going to say this right, Cartoon Institute.
Yes, the Cartoon Institute. Yes.
What can you tell me about that, or what happened with it?
Well, it's Craig and I basically were trying to recreate the atmosphere that we were allowed to be in at Oh Yeah and at What a Cartoon with a new pilot program at Cartoon Network. And mm-hmm. while we were wrapping up Foster's, we pitched this idea to the powers that be, you know, because basically Cartoon Network had not been generating a lot of new ideas in the last few years. And we felt like the best way to find series is to do pilots, you know, rather than talk about show concepts for 6 months, a year and a half, and get very little done on them. Why not go with ideas that you like and give somebody, you know, 7 or 11 minutes to prove them, prove if they're good or not. And we actually sold them on this bill of goods back in 2008 when money was flowing. Basically we just swiped Fred Seibert's model. We had artists come pitch to us the ideas that we thought had potential. We would commission a storyboard on. That storyboard would be put up on the wall and pitched to the two of us, Rob Sorcher, who's, the head of Cartoon Network, and three of our in-house artists, Derek Dryman, Chris Riccardi, and Dave Smith, who are all veterans of the industry, who've done various wonderful things. They did some of their own. They were brought in-house to do some of their own. They all ended up doing, Dave and Chris only ended up doing one, and Derek ended up doing two, and we ended up only doing 13 instead of, what were we slated at originally? I think we were slated to do 39, because in 2009, the money was not flowing, as everybody's aware. Everything crashed at the end of 2008. Our budgets got cut back, and our order got cut back, basically from how many do you got, how many to how many do we have now, and can we stop? Can we stop producing some of them? So a lot of things that were greenlit got passed on once they became an animatic and never got the animation, but we did end up producing 13 of them. And I guess some of them have escaped on YouTube now somehow, so you can actually see a few of them.
Yeah, amazing how that works, isn't it?
yeah, I don't know what happened. Someone put all of them up one weekend, and then they got taken down immediately, but some, in the meantime, people ripped them to their own computers, so they are popping up on YouTube, and we're very proud of them. We think they're as a group of shorts, they're very strong, and there's a lot of potential. One of them, JG Quintel's The Regular Show, has been picked up as a series by Cartoon Network, so that's a good start. I know a few of them are still being considered for series, so hopefully that will happen. That was always the end game, was to create more series for Cartoon Network. So hopefully people will be able to see all the shorts, and hopefully a lot of them will be made into actual shows.
Great. Yeah, that would be great. Let's see some new life,
Yes.
So what's next for Rob Renzetti? Where do you see yourself, or what are you doing today, and where do you see yourself 5 years from now? And
I can't think that far ahead. But, right now I've actually, I'm not sure where I'm going to end up next. There's a couple of different possibilities. I'm working on a children's book, which my literary agent's about to take around to different publishers and see if there's interest in that. It's actually based on one of my first year, shorts, that was called Ask Edward. It's called Don't Ask Edward. That's a possibility, maybe doing a children's book. I've been developing some of my own series and also just doing some work on Gendy's new show, Symbionic Titan, and on another show at Cartoon Network by Penn Ward called Adventure Time. I've been working on that on and off. So we'll see. I'm not sure. It's always a long shot to get your own show. I don't know if I'll ever get another of my own shows, but I've got a few ideas still left, and hopefully they'll find the light of day one way or another. So still working on a bunch of stuff. I'm not sure what form it'll all find itself in. Maybe as children's books, maybe as series, maybe as short stories, who knows, but I'm still creating, so we'll see. 5 years from now, who knows what could happen.
Yeah, no doubt. What I would like to see is a theatrical release of My Life as a Teenage Robot, and then we could see XJ10, see?
Yeah, that would be great. Stranger things have happened, though. I don't know. The show still plays on Nicktoons, and I think it does well on Nicktoons, and which is actually nice for me because my family back in Illinois actually has Nicktoons, and my brothers, my nieces and nephews can watch it now, so they're big fans of the show, so... people continue to watch it. Who knows? I would love to. It would be great to do a theatrical version of it, though. But I'm not sure. That's a very, very long shot. So keep your fingers crossed, but don't hold your breath.
Yeah. I wonder how it translates. How My Life as a Teenage Robot would translate, or if it has already. Maybe it has. You could tell me. But how it would translate to a comic book?
We did a couple of different short strips for the Nickelodeon magazine. Alex did the first, and then Joel Freemark, who is one of our character designers, did one as well. I think it translates great, but I haven't done anything comically with it yet. I've never done any comic books. It's there's a new idea I have that I've been just suggested to me. I should try and do it as like a mini comic book. So I'm thinking about diving into that now. I just finished up working on that children's book. So right now I was taking a little bit of a break, but that might be the next thing I tackle creatively, is starting to do comic book work. Yeah, I don't know. It could be a good comic book. I don't know. As much as I love the idea, I've put it down for 3 years now. So it's always a bit intimidating to pick it back up again. So we'll see if the right opportunity comes along to revisit those characters. I always, anything that could happen, I just love to do one more season, because I really wanted to do four seasons, and I had a lot of different ideas on that fourth season that would have advanced the story and the characters a lot. It would have been fun to do, and it would have been fun to give it an actual final episode, wrap it up, But by the time we found out we weren't picked up, the final episode was kind of already going through the production process. So I kind of tried to wrap it up in the final episode where Wakeman gets eaten. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but it's she gets eaten by this tiger at the end, and that was kind of a pseudo ending to the show. Though of course she's still alive inside the tiger, but I guess you could say it wrapped up because Wakeman was eaten. But that wasn't much of an ending. Would have liked to have given it a more proper ending, but I know the fans were expecting there was going to be some kind of Jenny and Brad get together, or Sheldon and Brad Sheldon and Brad. Wow, that would have been quite an ending. No, Sheldon and Jenny getting together. But no, we didn't have a chance to plan anything like that, and I don't think I would have planned anything like that anyways. Just to disappoint the soap opera fans of the show, but I don't think those love interests would have ever amounted to anything. But anyways, it would have been nice to do another season. So, but it was not to be.
Well, I guess that's it for the questioning. I want to thank you very much for your time, and I really appreciate
you
coming on. And
sure.
Good luck with your children's book. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Rob Renzetti as much as I did. It's always a great learning experience when I get to talk to these creative professionals and learn about their career paths, their processes, their techniques, and everything involved in doing what they do best, which is entertain us and just keep us happy through whatever means their medium is, whether it's animation, comic strips, comic books, illustrations. It's just so motivational to talk to these guys and gals that it really makes it a pleasure to do this show. So anyway, I hear the music coming in. It's starting to telling me it's time for me to split. Thanks again for listening to the Boing podcast. My son told me that it sounded a lot like Boring Podcast. Maybe I need to change the name. I originally was going to call it Zoinks, and then I changed it to Boing. But what do you think? Should it be Zoinks? I don't know. Music's coming in. I'm going out. Take care, everybody. Have a great week. So long. And Dad, if you're out there, this one's for you.